From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Donald Trump met with corporate leaders today, including Elon Musk of SpaceX and Marilyn Hewson of Lockheed Martin. He said he'd impose a substantial border tax on products made by companies that move their manufacturing operations abroad and want to send products back to the U.S. And he promised tax advantages for the firms that do make their products here in the U.S. And to make it easier for them to do so, he promised a cutback in government regulations.
We think we can cut regulations by 75%, maybe more, but by 75%, have, in a certain way, better protections. But when you want to expand your plant, or when Mark wants to come in and build a big, massive plant, or when Dell wants to come in and do something monstrous and special, you're going to have your approvals really fast.
There's also the president's battle with the media about inauguration attendance and his executive order on day one on the Affordable Care Act. And now it is just day four. Joining us, NPR Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Robin.
75% cutback in regulations. Do we know anything more specific?
You know, we don't. We don't really know where he's coming up with that number. We'd have to suspect he is talking largely about environmental regulations because he did make specific reference to big new manufacturing plants. Now, you heard him talk about Mark Fields, CEO of Ford. And then one of the people who came out and spoke briefly to reporters outside the White House was the head of Dow Chemical. That's a business with a lot of environmental impact issues. As for the exact 75%, you know, that might be a precise calculation by skilled and knowledgeable staffers in the back room, or it might be a totally notional number thrown out for effect, sort of a Trumpian number based on imagination.
Okay, well, we'll follow that. But now Obamacare, as even President Obama claimed it was, Trump's executive order seems to give agencies the right to stop penalizing citizens who don't have health care. What are you reading into that executive order?
It is aimed at some of the most unpopular elements of Obamacare, such as the individual mandate and the enforcement mechanisms like the IRS power to tax you if you don't buy insurance. Some people we've seen, even now, would rather pay the fine, as it were, rather than buy coverage. And this would appear to let those folks off the hook. The problem, of course, is that without the individual mandate and the enforcement mechanism, the numbers don't work out for insurance companies to hold up their end of the bargain. And the word from Capitol Hill is that the replacement for Obamacare is not ready yet. Ready, not yet. Ready, not yet.
Let's listen to a little bit of Kellyanne Conway, a counselor to the president. She was speaking about many things over the weekend, but she did talk about the executive order on health care and also touched on Saturday's Women's March on Washington across the country, around the world, numbers that far exceeded anyone's thoughts about that. Here she's talking with ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
He's going to replace this with a plan that allows you to buy insurance across state lines that is much more centered around the patient and access to health care. And I wish I had heard more of that from the women yesterday here in Washington. Why aren't they talking about the millions of women who live in poverty, who don't have health care after 8 years of
President
Obama?
What did the president think of that march?
I discussed it with him briefly. We certainly respect people's First Amendment rights, but I frankly didn't see the point. I mean,
Ron Elving, take up. There's a couple things there. Many of the marchers were talking about women's health care. But your sense overall of what has turned into a battle over the weekend of perception and reality and facts.
Yes. And we were talking a moment ago about numbers based on imagination. The president threw out a million and a half. Those are two very different numbers in estimating the crowd. And from where he was standing, I'm sure it did appear to be a vast and perhaps even innumerable assembly. That was his crowd on Friday. Of a lot of other people taking pictures, looking at the pictures, comparing them to previous inaugurations, have told a very, very different story, estimating his crowd at well under half of what the crowd was, say, in 2009. Now, when it turns to this demonstration on Saturday, I can understand why Kellyanne Conway would not really want to dwell on that too long because it was being perceived largely as a protest against Donald Trump. And he had two tweets on Saturday. The first one, he said that, hey, I thought we just had an election. Didn't these people vote? And he also said that the celebrity speakers were hurting their own cause. Later on, he sent out a more magnanimous tweet in which he said everyone has a right to free speech.
I guess just, you know, in the few seconds we have, others have said, why bring it up at all? You know, why bring up a debate over the numbers at your inauguration? Because it only focuses attention on it.
Yes, but it appears that he was stung by it, and he sent out his press secretary and communications director, Sean Spicer, on Saturday afternoon, accusing the media of deliberately distorting this issue in these numbers. And he was, of course, immediately snowed under with evidence to the contrary, and we haven't heard from him since.
Yeah. Senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving, there are many stings in a president's life. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, according to the Centers for Disease Control, last year was one of the worst years for mumps in the U.S. in decades. There were several outbreaks in Texas, a handful of cases linked to a Halloween party in Dallas, other cases linked to a cheerleading contest in Arlington. Medical experts place some of the blame on the lack of vaccinations, parents who are opting out of vaccinations for their kids. Texas lawmakers have been trying to eliminate state exemptions that allow people to opt out, and now they've got a new strategy. Lauren Silverman from KERA in Dallas reports.
State Representative Jason Vialba has two kids in Dallas public schools. They're both vaccinated against highly contagious diseases like mumps and measles. But a few years ago, he learned not all their classmates were.
My wife came home from school after registration, and she mentioned to me that under Texas law that a school could or a student could opt out of the protocols for immunization merely by saying that they don't want to take immunizations. And that was surprising to me. I thought that was odd.
The Republican learned that in 2013, the state legislature added in this so-called conscientious objection option for parents who didn't want immunizations.
Sure enough, it coincided with this paper by Andrew Wakefield.
Wakefield is the British researcher who published a fraudulent 1998 study linking immunizations to autism.
Of course, that study was widely discredited. His license was removed to practice medicine in the UK, and now he lives in Austin.
Learning all this, Vialba wrote a bill in 2015 that would have eliminated the conscientious objection clause. He would have kept the medical and religious exemptions available. He knew touching a hot topic like vaccines would be contentious, but he had no idea what he'd be up against.
It got ugly at times, heated at times.
Well, we got heavily involved at the Capitol in his primary race. We knocked on over 10,000 doors for his challenger.
Jackie Schlegel is the force behind Texans for Vaccine Choice. It's the grassroots group that tried to topple Vialba.
We are not here to tell parents to or to not vaccinate. We are simply here to defend the rights of parents to make those decisions.
Texans for Vaccine Choice is now a political action committee. Nearly 10,500 people have liked its Facebook page. And although Vialba did win re-election last fall, he gave up on his legislation.
And what we found is that only if there is, I hate to say this, a situation where children are being affected in a very public way, like they were in California with Disneyland with the measles outbreak, only then would we in Texas have the will to move forward with this. And unfortunately, as I predicted, we're starting to see that now.
He's referring to the recent outbreaks of mumps. Health officials identified more than 100 people infected with mumps in North Texas, most of which were students. What really has doctors worried, though, is measles. There was a measles outbreak in 2013 that infected nearly two dozen people at a North Texas megachurch. Dr. Peter Hotez is dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston.
Measles is one of the great killers of children in the world. More than 100,000 children die every year of measles. And my big concern is if we start seeing continued drops in vaccination rates, we could start seeing measles outbreaks in Texas.
There are a handful of bills this session that would make it harder to get philosophical exemptions to vaccines. None would eliminate such exemptions, like the law that passed in California in 2015 or the bill Vialba proposed. Still, Vialba supports a plan by his Republican colleague in Houston, Sarah Davis. She wants to require an online course for parents who want to opt out of immunizations.
I think she does have a chance this time. I know she's got the support of all the MDs in the House.
Another bill authored by Representative Donna Howard, an Austin Democrat and nurse, would require parents to consult with a doctor about the dangers of not immunizing a child. Members of Texans for Vaccine Choice, like Jackie Schlegel, are opposed to both proposals.
our stance is that these are personal and private decisions that are best left that way. Texas has a very long history of supporting parental rights and vaccine choice, and we are here to maintain that.
The decisions made in Texas could spread. Here's Dr. Peter Hotez.
You know, the U.S. is very good at exporting culture. We export Hollywood movies. We can export anti-vaccine sentiments. And you can imagine when vaccine rates start going down in places like India or Nigeria or Brazil, we could have catastrophic measles epidemics and other epidemics globally.
For now, the debate remains in the State House, where legislators have to balance parental choice and public safety in an interconnected world. For Here and Now, I'm Lauren Silverman in Dallas.
And our next guest does something as a volunteer that for many people would be too difficult to bear. She sits with hospital patients as they're dying. She's part of a program called No One Dies Alone that ensures that terminal patients aren't by themselves when they pass away. It started in Eugene, Oregon in 2001, and now volunteers can be found in hospitals across the country. Marilyn Judson volunteers at the Santa Monica UCLA Hospital in California. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
And how did you first find out about this program and decide that you wanted to volunteer to sit with people and be with people as they're dying?
I first heard about it on NPR about 8 or 10 years ago.
Hmm.
And then when it came to UCLA in 2014, I immediately wanted to be part of it. But I understand it was started by a woman named Sandra Clark, who was an ICU nurse and just felt heartbroken one night when she was not able to stay with a patient who had asked her to stay with him because he felt he was near death. And she said, "I'll come back as soon as I've done my rounds." And by the time she got back, he had passed away. Mm. So apparently from that night on, she started organizing her coworkers, and eventually it spread to the community, and they elicited volunteer help to let no one die alone.
So tell us what it's like to do it, to sit with somebody as they're dying.
Most of the patients with whom I've sat have been non-responsive. In other words, they don't open their eyes, they don't speak, but we're told that the last senses to go at the time of death are hearing and touch. So our training involves letting them know what we're doing, giving them information. "Hi, this is Marilyn. I'm here to just keep you company. I'm a volunteer with the hospital, and I'll be here holding your hand and letting me moistening your lips or whatever it looks like you may need." And then from there, I often, if I've had permission from the nurses or the family, I often lift my golden retriever therapy dog, Frank, up onto the bed with them. First put down a clean sheet and then left Frank up next to them so he's kind of lying along their side. So that gives this soft, warm animal presence next to them.
Do they react to that?
Sometimes, yes. Yeah, there was one patient, Robert, who had cancer. This is several years ago. And I came to his room several times while he was still responsive in my role in the UCLA People-Animal Connection, which is just simply visit with a dog from patient to patient, whoever the nurses recommend or whoever has requested it. And Robert refused me not once, not twice, but I think three times. He said he just had too much to do. There was too much going on. And I found out later from the palliative care nurses that he was calling every available specialist and trying every possible way to avoid accepting the terminal diagnosis that he had been given. Not that I don't believe in trying every option mm-hmm. available, but there are some people that do not go gentle into that good night, and Robert was one of those. By the time I came the fourth time, so this would be 4 weeks after I first met Robert, he was basically non-responsive. So I talked with the nurses, and I said, do you think this might be helpful? He has refused me before, and they encouraged me to visit him with my golden retriever. So I went into the room, put down the sheet on Robert's bed, and then lifted Frank up onto his bed so he was lying kind of along his thigh and his calf. And this man hadn't said anything for several days, hadn't opened his eyes. But as soon as Frank was in position next to him, he did open his eyes and looked down towards his legs, saw Frank, and said, oh, how wonderful.
Hmm.
So I sat there with him and held his hand. And Frank, who is the most patient animal I've ever met, he was just immobile during that time. I've seen him do this with several patients that are near the end. We sat there for 2 hours.
Hmm.
And I like to think it comforted him. When I was first visiting him, there was a lot of anxiety in the room, a lot of tension in the room. But after I'd been there with Frank for a short while, the atmosphere lightened. And I think Frank and I were helpful to him. I held his hand. What I often do is I hold the patient's hand, and then if they're responsive, I ask their permission. If they're not, I just quietly repeat some phrases for their well-being that go along the lines of, may you be happy, may you be free from suffering, may you be at ease, may you be free. And I keep repeating those phrases in my mind, usually directing them to the patient, but every once in a while, if I feel like I'm becoming overwhelmed, I'll direct them to myself silently and maybe stroke the patient's head during some of that or just continue to hold his or her hand. And what those phrases do is they keep me in the room. They keep my mind from wandering.
Hmm.
They keep me focused on this drama that is taking place in front of me. This person is soon to die.
Well, and a lot of people would find it very difficult to do what you do. They don't want to be around death. They're afraid of it. They don't want to witness it. Has that ever been a problem for you?
Sure. Sure. There's much about death that's frightening. I'm fond of saying it's this culture's last taboo. But, you know, we do all have the same path. In spite of all evidence to the contrary, we like to think that each of us, especially if you're American, is going to live forever. And it's not the case. There's always been something mysterious to me. It's been a poignant mystery ever since I was a child about death. And I've long wanted to understand it better, to explore it, to just, there's something about being in a room with a dying person that's on the edge of that frontier, the edge of that unknown country, that's like looking into the eye of God. It's just a sacred time. And I feel, in spite of how unpleasant it might be in some cases, I feel privileged. I feel privileged to be there and to be helping with this passage.
And it's not emotionally draining for you?
It's very emotionally draining, and I do it again in a minute.
Hmm.
It's both heart-wrenching and soul-filling at the same time.
How many people have you sat with while they were dying?
Oh, I'd say maybe 15 or 20 over the last several years. And when I finish, often I'm drained, and I'll call a friend, or I'll just go home and hug my husband and hug Frank. And after a little while, I feel okay again. But I turn down very few of the calls that we get when someone is close to dying, and they don't have any friends or family around them, I usually make an effort to go in because, like I said, I think it's a privilege, and also I know how much I would want that for myself. My mother ended up dying without either myself or my dad at the bedside. This is probably part of what motivates me in this program. And fortunately, there was a nurse there, Kathy, who held her hand the last several minutes of her life and said, "Your husband loves you, your daughter loves you." And that was a great comfort to me, and I like to think it was a comfort to my mother as she took her last few breaths. So I guess I do it partly for that, and then just sometimes when I'm with a patient, I'm aware they're dying, and then it makes my own life more precious. I'm simultaneously aware of the gift of my own life. Hmm. And the crushing sadness of eventually losing that life. And it's because life is framed by death, that if you really face that, really accept it, internalize it, then every moment of life becomes more poignant, more precious, less likely to waste it on trivia.
Well, thank you for doing what you're doing as a volunteer for No One Dies Alone in California. It sounds like a great program. Marilyn Judson, we really appreciate you talking to us about it.
Thank you for inviting me. Thanks for thinking of the Santa Monica UCLA Hospital.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
And the pictures out of Georgia and Mississippi today are incredible. This weekend, tornadoes left 19 dead, dozens injured. Jim Cantore is a meteorologist with the Weather Channel. And Jim, we're hearing that more people died over the weekend from the tornadoes than all tornado-related deaths last year.
In two nights, that's correct. We had 17 casualties last year, all of last year. And so far, you know, it's early. This isn't even peak tornado time. We have 19 casualties, 15 in Georgia and 4 in Mississippi.
Oh, just terrible. And as you said, not even tornado season. So why were there tornadoes? What was the storm effect?
It was really a rare combination of, you know, pretty well-advertised overnight event. But if everyone doesn't get that message, which people often don't in January, they think, oh, it's wintertime. We can't have tornadoes in the winter. Yeah. That's totally incorrect when it comes to the South. Dixie Alley, as we call it, can have them any time of the year. Yeah. It was, you know, and it's been very, very warm. We've had record warm temperatures for a week. There's been moisture. You know, it almost feels like May versus January, that's for sure. And when you get a strong system in the upper levels that came out of California, like this one did, you set yourself up for 2 to 3 days of severe weather. And unfortunately, those tornadoes that occurred happened, a lot of them, during the overnight and early morning.
Jim, when you see those pictures, you call this a tornado outbreak. 50 miles an hour, that's the speed at which they're moving. When you see this hitting on your maps, you know, what are you thinking?
I just hope everybody has enough warning to get to a safe place.
Because you know.
And when they're moving that fast, I mean, think about it. When you pass somebody on a highway at 60 miles an hour and you're stopped and pulled over, they go by you pretty quickly. Yeah. So that's kind of what happens with a tornado. I mean, it comes and goes, you know, in about 20, 30 seconds, and that's it.
Yeah.
But by that time, you lose your roof, you lose the windows, you've got flying debris, and hopefully you weren't sucked out of your house. But these were very strong tornadoes, the ones that produced the casualties. So you're talking about winds up around 150 miles an hour or stronger.
Mm. Yeah. Well, what's ahead?
Well, we finally get back to a little bit more winter-like weather, if you will. I mean, it's not really Arctic air, so it's not super cold. But, you know, instead of Chicago being 52, they're going to be 32 by the time Friday rolls around. Atlanta, instead of being 72, they're going to be 52. Mm. So much more seasonable-like weather. But, you know, we got to get through today and tomorrow and Wednesday with snow for the Midwest and plains, and a lot of wind in the Northeast. It's going to feel like there's a hurricane on the East Coast.
We were hearing 70 miles an hour in New York.
You could easily guess to that, yes. I think the better chance for that is probably the South Shore of Long Island, the Cape, Nantucket, and Martha's Vineyard, to get those kind of gusts. But it's not out of the realm of possibility to get to 70.
Well, are we out of the woods on this particular storm system? We hear Florida is bracing for storms.
In terms of severe weather, I think the threat is over for Florida. It's all moved off the East Coast at this time. Again, just like everybody else, really, east of the Rockies, this one low pressure system, which is very strong over interior Kentucky, Virginia, Tennessee, is dominating the weather. And very strong wind gusts surround that low, whether it be on the Northeast Coast, on the west side of this, into Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and even into Florida. Very, very windy day.
Jim Cantore of the Weather Channel. Jim, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Are you a procrastinator? Do you leave everything until the last minute, or even just some things? Do you think you could stop procrastinating if you wanted to? Well, joining us now with some answers via Skype is Tim Pitchell, who's an associate professor of psychology and part of the Procrastination Research Group at Carleton University in Canada. Tim Pitchell, welcome.
Thanks, Jeremy.
So is there more to procrastination than just putting things off for another time? Why do we do it?
Well, there's lots of kinds of delay, and procrastination is one form of delay. It's an irrational form of delay because it's a voluntary delay of an intended act. Even though we figure, all things considered, the world's not perfect, we figure we'll probably be worse off for it. So it's a self-defeating delay. There's really no upside to it.
There's no upside to procrastination ever?
Well, that's not true. We can all remember a time we procrastinated and it really paid off, and we hang on to that like gold. Because we want to use that to fuel the self-deception that really is at the heart of procrastination. So, yes, procrastination can pay, but it's usually harmful.
When you say it's harmful, what do you mean? Why is it harmful to procrastinate?
Well, first of all, the research evidence shows that it typically results in poorer performance, whether that be an academic setting or other places. Again, though, we all know people who seem to be good performers and procrastinate. But that gets to the next thing. The research also shows us that it really affects our well-being negatively. But most recently, our research has shown that it affects our health negatively as well. We have fewer wellness behaviors. Well, first of all, we have the direct effects of stress. Then we have fewer wellness behaviors and more treatment delay. So really, procrastination across the board, across all the studies that I know, shows that it has negative consequences.
Are people conscious that they're procrastinating, or is it sometimes something we do without noticing?
Well, I think that when it becomes a habit, like all habits, they're non-conscious, and we can do it without noticing at first. But we do recognize that by definition, again, it's a voluntary delay of an intention. So we get to a point in the day where we face that intention and we say, I don't feel like it, I don't want to, and we put it off. That's where the story starts, because we get that immediate reward of getting rid of the negative emotions. I don't feel like it, I don't want to. And then we also know that we're aware of it, because the major emotion associated with procrastination is guilt. And we have to manage that guilt somehow.
And some procrastinators would argue that they're doing it on purpose because they perform better under stress. They would rather leave their task until the end, because then they'll really get it done and they'll do it well.
Well, they want to say that. In fact, we've done experience sampling studies where we put pagers on students and we page them throughout a week. And early in the week, when they weren't doing what they're supposed to be doing, they will say things like, I work better under pressure, I'll feel more like it tomorrow. But when the final hour came and they were actually on task, because most people finally get there, none of our participants were saying, I'm glad I waited to now because I work so much better under pressure. In fact, they were saying things like, I don't know why I was avoiding this. Isn't as bad as I thought, and I could do a much better job if I gave it more time. In experimental studies, we find that people working under pressure make more errors of omission and commission. So we'd like to believe we work better under pressure, but what really is that we only work under pressure, and there's quite a bit of pathos in that.
So what are some of the ways people can stop procrastinating?
Well, we have to recognize that procrastination is not a time management problem. It's an emotion regulation problem. We're misregulating our emotions to try to feel good now. So if we start there and recognize, oh, I want to believe that I'm going to feel like it tomorrow, but I'm not, and acknowledge that feeling, but say, you know, I don't know why I ever got to the point in my life where I believe I have to be in the mood to do something. If I waited to be in the mood to do most things, I'd be doing nothing. So once we start there and recognize the problem for what it is, it's a coping response, an emotion coping response, then I can think of other responses, and then I can recognize, no, I'm not going to feel more like doing this tomorrow, so I'll just get started now. What's the next action I could do, and really take it small, like that tiny first step, because we know that progress on a goal fuels our well-being and our motivation. And if you can do that, you can typically get over the resistance that we feel about starting.
You have to basically say to yourself, I don't want to do this, and I admit that I don't want to do this, but I need to do it right now.
Yeah, and there's so much more in there that, you know, we kind of have this six-year-old alive and well in us. I know my children are a little older than that now, but only by a bit, and they'll still say the same things to me. I don't feel like it. I don't want to. And we get into these discussions with children about, you know, it's not about what you feel or what you want, but adults do it all the time. We grow up thinking somehow we need to be in the mood and I have to want to do things, and that just doesn't work. In fact, it's a very inefficient way to live.
Do you think that the issue of procrastination is becoming a bigger problem than it has been in the past?
Yes. And the reason for that, I think, is, you know, just recently we celebrated the birth of the iPhone, and all these technologies, particularly that are in our hand, play into the human nature not to want to delay gratification. And so we can just slide onto that slippery slope of, it'll only take a minute to update my Facebook or check Instagram or whatever your favorite social media is. And of course, a minute later, you face the same decision. And 3 hours later, you're wondering why you're looking at videos of kittens and binging on Netflix, right? And because you never made a decision, it was always that it'll only take a minute. And we love to be distracted. We want to feel good now. So that's a real problem in our world when distraction is in our hands. So we've always procrastinated, but when distraction is so easy, it becomes much more likely that that's going to be our favorite poison.
Is it your favorite poison? Do you procrastinate?
No, you know, I used to a lot. But after 22 years of studying this, I don't have a lot of wiggle room around the self-deception. And I've also learned to develop some habits in my life that keep me focused. And I use all the strategies that I've learned from my research, like what's the next action and not focusing on my emotions and recognizing that I'm not going to feel more like it tomorrow. And in our most recent research, we've been looking at present self versus future self. And so I just do a bit of time travel and say, what's future self going to think about this? And I think, oh, yeah, I better get started. So, no, I don't really procrastinate at all anymore, Jeremy.
That's Tim Pitchell, who is an associate professor of psychology and part of the Procrastination Research Group at Carleton University in Canada. Tim, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, as we saw with the women's marches across the country on Saturday, the country remains divided as Donald Trump begins his first full week in office. But Youth Radio's Hannah Adams, who is 17 and lives in Letcher, Kentucky, says people there have a different way of handling disagreement.
I grew up in Letcher, Kentucky. It's a small town in Appalachia, you know, coal country. I guess you could call us one of those working class places you hear so much about lately. But the more I hear talk about rural communities like ours, the less I feel like the rest of the country understands us at all. People seem to think we're living in the past, like we're all hillbillies on food stamps or closed-minded conservatives who only value coal. But that's not the truth. The biggest difference between where I live and most of America is that in a small town like this, we can't afford to stay divided. Like any community, we have our political disagreements. The presidential election results were a surprise to all of us. Local Trump supporters and haters alike never expected him to pull through. But even though there are people in my town who aren't happy about Trump becoming president, no one is going to break out the protest signs or set stuff on fire. In a city, if you tick someone off, you can retreat, find a bubble of people who agree with you. But here, you can't isolate yourself. We run into each other in the aisles of grocery stores. All the kids go to one big high school. And even though a lot of younger people aren't crazy about coal, they're guaranteed to have a relative that worked in the mines. So even though all the tensions dividing our country exist here, they happen in very close quarters. For example, there's a guy in my town who went to a pro-Trump inauguration party with his family and then an anti-Trump gathering with friends that night. At school, there are kids who are pro-Trump and anti-Trump, but we don't get into screaming fights in class. The biggest demonstration on Inauguration Day was at a local radio station where the DJs decided to play protest songs. We know yelling back and forth will only result in hurt feelings, so when politics do come up, here's how we handle it. We listen. We respect each other, because at the end of the day, we can't afford not to. For Here and Now, I'm Hannah Adams.
And it's a drag when you open up your social media and a toxic, belittling post or meme pops up. It can also be bullying and devastating, especially for young people. What if instead there was an anonymous compliment? A new app called Brighton drew 5,000 users in its first 3 months. It's now got 1 million users sending over 10 million messages a month to brighten people's lives. 25-year-old Austin Kevich is founder and CEO. He joins us from Santa Monica, California. Hi, Austin.
Hi, Robin.
So how did this come to you? We understand you were at Bucknell when something actually kind of sad happened that prompted some of this thinking.
Yes, in 2013, my junior year, I was actually playing football and I suffered a spine injury. So I decided to take the semester off and study in Cape Town, South Africa. And while I was in Cape Town, I had a friend that I made there suddenly pass away in a rock climbing accident. And after he passed away, everyone from throughout his life started writing really, really nice things on his Facebook wall. And it kind of just made me think, like, this sucks that he couldn't have seen this stuff while he was still alive.
Yeah. And you also had another inspiration. I love this idea. You were visiting a friend, and the friend's little sister took out an old tissue box that had been converted. Mm-hmm. What was that box?
Yeah, so my friend's little sister put a tissue box on the dinner table and wrote compliment box on it. And the family members would write something nice about another family member and drop the note in a box. And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And even I would write stuff about people in the family, and they had no idea it was coming from me. And after my friend's death, I was inspired to bring back that compliment box and try it with my friends there. And it was crazy. Like, people started walking to our house from all over campus and just writing nice things about their friends and dropping it in the box.
And so you thought, what about a virtual compliment box?
I kind of just thought, how do I get this to more people? So a mobile app was the obvious solution.
It's, of course, because you're 25. So, of course, you're thinking, I'm going to build a mobile app. And you you did. You met a programmer through the Kairos Society, K-A-I-R-O-S. They bring entrepreneurs together, invested a couple thousand dollars, and then released this app in 2014. So how does it work? You go on and do what?
You go on and you make a profile. You add friends. And when you post someone a compliment, they don't know it's from you in the beginning. The reason for that is that I think the reason why we don't say a lot of the nice things we're thinking about people in real life is because it can feel awkward. There's definitely this awkward barrier to telling people how you really feel, especially in high school. So with Brighton, we made it fun and easy by saying, like, hey, write whatever you want to write to this person. They won't know it's from you. And then you can reveal yourself when you want to.
So you have this company, I mean, that you've built, people actually working for you doing this. Why do people need a compliment app? Why can't somebody just say, you know what, on a daily basis, I'm going to send an email to someone or a tweet to somebody with a compliment?
We make it as easy as possible to make everyone smile. Like, it only takes a couple seconds to type out a nice compliment to someone and click send, and then you get to see their smile through the app, and you can do that to 10, 20, 30 people within the span of minutes. Whereas in real life, you can't really just go down a line and compliment people. I wish you could, but we hope that Brighton takes something that's happening in real life and makes it easier.
It's anonymous initially.
Yeah, so the compliment itself is anonymous initially. So it's kind of like a way to overcome that awkwardness and get your foot in the door. And then when you see the person smile, you can be like, hey, I wrote that.
How do you see them smile?
They can take a selfie and everyone can see it for only 1 second and then disappears. So, like, a smile happens in real life. It happens and then it's gone.
Now I know you're working with anti-bullying groups. How's that working?
We partnered up with a couple nonprofits, such as Harmony Power and Be Cool, Be Nice. And we're working on putting together some events at schools.
Do you worry about misuse of your app, you know, stalkers or people able now to send anonymous messages to someone?
So what we've come to find is that everyone is guilty of having a bad day and projecting onto other people. And it's those kind of people that probably can use the positivity more than anyone. So what we do is if there's any harassment in the app, instead of banning them, we'll leave those people on the app so they can consume all the positivity. And then we'll just monitor them. So everything they post, we will approve of it or it won't get posted.
Well, Austin Kevich, again, who developed this Brighton app to help send anonymous compliments to anyone you know. Good luck to you.
Can I give one person a shout out?
Sure.
So one of the members of Team Brighton, Ryan Romanchuk, is obsessed with your show, Robin. So I just want to embarrass him a little bit. He's a pilot, a photographer, tornado chaser, plays the guitar.
Wait, this is sounding like a dating site.
He's single. He's 31. It's a great catch.
Hey, you know what? I'm going to go on your app and I'm going to send him an anonymous greeting.
Please, that would make his day.
Take care.
Thank you.
So, dear Roman, you sound like such a catch. What do you think, Jeremy? I'll send that out. Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.